We get on board the telephone line and welcome in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
I must ask you here, it's a trade deadline day, Major League Baseball. The Red Sox let their starting catcher go, traded away a left-handed reliever, and then picked up, I guess we can safely call them, two aging veterans. Is this schizophrenic management, or is there some hidden genius there?
I don't know about the last part. Did that happen today, the aging veterans?
They picked up Eric Hosmer from the Padres.
The Padres really seem to be going for it, but it's I don't like any of the Kimball. I mean, it's not like I have a problem with Christian Vasquez going, but it's just such an off-putting product. Chaim Bloom doesn't really seem to know anything about baseball. I don't even know if he likes baseball. And I just don't get any of it. It's baffling to me. It's all of it. The way that Vasquez was talked about when he was traded last night, his teammates and the fans and all the people on Twitter, you'd think this was 1977 Carlton Fisk, wouldn't you? I mean, I realize that they don't have a major league catcher. He has 8 home runs. I mean, he's going to hit like 11 and have 54 RBI. And if his average stays the same, be like, what, 270 and OPS plus of 102? And everyone's like, oh, we've let this cornerstone go. It's like, has that happened? No, they're not going anywhere. I find all of it just, even the analysts they have in when it's not Eckersley, I just find all of it this year, there's nothing there for me. And the veteran thing, you mentioned schizophrenic. I have no idea what the thinking is there. I mean, do you?
No. Well, I think they were trying to get the best of both worlds, maybe unload some contracts and get some value for them while staying just competitive enough to maybe make the third wild card spot in a year where there's lots of mediocrity. And maybe the fans will be happy with that.
Would you, and like I just said, I mean, I'm not some massive proponent of the guy, but would you then dump the only fanciful like catcher you have? Like theoretical catcher you have on the team, and who is the catcher without? I mean, at least he's average. Who is the? It's an important position. Who is the catcher without this guy? Like, what do you do?
Right,
who's the backup catcher?
You got Plawecki, and they did pick up backup Reese McGuire from the Chicago White Sox, who I supposedly is a good defender, but not much of a hitter. Oh, good. I will say, though, and I think you can agree with this, I will not miss watching Christian Vasquez get thrown out trying to take an extra base because he might be the worst base runner in all of Major League Baseball.
He's not good at that's for sure. The thing that I found frustrating about him more than anything, you get sort of like the middling production at the plate. He should have been, in my view, a lot better defensively. And the reason he wasn't was sort of twofold. I don't think he kept himself in the best physical shape. I'm just looking at the guy. He's podgy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's not like, you can be a big guy and be a catcher. He's not solid. He's like doughy. And then he would have these mental lapses. And more so than throwing guys out, it would be on these pass balls, like a plethora of pass balls. And when he had them, they weren't kind of like borderline wild pitches. They were just that he was out to lunch and it ricocheted off his glove and went to the backstop. And he was never an all-star. He was never a contender, really, for a gold glove. He had the one year, the odd year, where he hits 20 home runs. Never come close to that. It's like different level of player, obviously. But no one ever talked about this. Like, I remember Kirby Puckett. One year he hits like 3 home runs or 1 or 2 or something like that. Then the next year he's like, hey, 30. Like, no one really questioned it. It's like, huh, I wonder what might be going on here. And then what stopped going on. And I know that he worked hard. I think this past year he was in winter ball, wasn't he?
I think so.
To work on his offense with the contract year. But I don't know. I don't think the general manager is someone who knows anything about baseball. I think he just looks at pieces of paper. And maybe it's going to come back around the other way where we actually have to look at the sports and know the sports, and it's not just like numbers and going to Yale, and you have to know what's happening on the field.
Crazy concept, but we'll see if it grows in popularity down the road. We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. I want to talk about this wonderful story of yours, My Nickel, that it sounds like began as a work of nonfiction and then went to some different places, but just an incredibly powerful piece about something seemingly so mundane.
I remember we talked once about, I'd said it to you, I said, oh, I could write a story about a pencil. And then I did. And so that's not what I was thinking here, but it's really a story about what it says it is. It's about a nickel, and it's a nickel from 1941. The main character, there are a lot of main characters, but maybe the mainest character, if you will, is this actual piece of metal. And it's a 2,500-word story, and it was something that I knew I was going to like put it up on the blog, because I actually had this old nickel, and I noticed things like that. And theoretically, anyone is free to. I always say that the world gives you stories if you know how to be in the world, and you know how to listen to the world and see the world. And so other people can go out and get their change back or whatever. And in, like I said, in theory, it could become this thing. But I was writing this blog, and I thought, you know what, this is going to be, just do it straight out. And so it was this piece. And then as I'm writing this piece, I'm thinking, you know what, this isn't really classifiable, because if you wanted to call this nonfiction, it's really comprised of all of these sub-narratives of what are fiction. But they're also, in a way, there's this point in the story where, talking about these different characters, and the narrator says, you can't say that this thing I'm postulating didn't happen. And I love that idea, because who's to say it wasn't something that was real? But we also can't definitively prove that it was something that historically occurred. So now we're in the realm of fiction. But we're in a realm of fiction that is in a different key than anyone else is going to write fiction in.
And it's that ability to stop and focus on that one thing in that moment, and then imagine the possibilities. And you talk about your family. You talk about a wonderful story about a little girl that you imagine. And I love the idea of a device in the future that might tell you about everyone that ever had that nickel before you in those, whatever it is, 81 years in circulation.
Well, it's not my family. I mean, again, we're in, this isn't biography.
Right.
It's not autobiography. It's like some of the main characters, for instance, are a nurse, and the nurse has, and we have these people in the story from World War II, like these three people. I mean, it covers, it's the grand elegiac sweep of humanity in this story about a nickel. And you can really think hard about a nickel. Where has that nickel been? Who has had that nickel? Have you had that nickel before? Has that nickel turned up in the possessions of someone who went to a hotel and couldn't go on anymore and ended their life? And that was what, like, their family came to claim later with their meager belongings. Was it something that gave somebody hope at a different point? Was it the means of vital life-saving phone call, whatever it may have been? So there is this nurse in the story, and we go quite a bit into her life, where she's dragging at work and she's dragging in a relationship, and she goes on break. She goes across the street from the hospital to get this sort of restorative cup of coffee. She goes back to her job, and she's a rock for this family that night that's going through something exceedingly difficult. And that sort of gives her this inspiration or this courage or this strength in her own life to have this difficult conversation with this person she's in a relationship with, and the relationship isn't working out, and yet they're going to part as friends, and they're going to marry other people, and they're going to mean things to each other's kids, and they're going to be there for each other when the one's spouse dies, and all this stuff. It spins off in all of these different directions, and yet it's unified, and we see this part with this girl, and the nickel has come to reside in this piggy bank. And this family has gone through a tragedy, and she thinks that this money she saved up is going to be able to do something of the grandest consequence. And I think one of the my favorite things that I've ever seen is the exchange she has with her dad when they're trying to do something nice for the mom, and how the dad allows his kid to think that this is the money that allows them to do this. It's good thing she saved, because they just barely got to the figure they needed to reach.
And it's a simple question, but a profound one that the narrator asks. Is a nickel ever really a nickel?
And the answer clearly when you read the story is no. I mean, at one point we're in a mall, and you know, those fountains in malls where everyone throws the coins in. And the developer, whoever it is, says to the custodian, if you clean out this fountain, you can take the coins. And the guy's kind of looking at and our nickel is in there, and he's looking at this, and he doesn't know if it's $78 or $780 that would be in there, because you really don't know unless you're like in the habit, I mean, I am, of going to the supermarket with like tins, coffee cans full of coins. Like I know when I have a good haul. Most people don't know. And so he doesn't even really know if it's worth it. And there's this part about an app where if you had this app that would tell you all the people who've owned your nickel before you. And the narrator is talking about how in relation to his mother, like he wouldn't know, but there's like this amazing sort of imagined across the ages conversation that goes on in this like subjunctive universe, in which Billie Holiday of all people factors, where he's speaking to his mother in 1961. I mean, I wrote this in an hour. It's 2,500 words long, and it's just, there it is, like fully formed and unclassifiable, and the ending is, I think it's a complete surprise. I mean, I was looking at it today before coming on, because it's like from last Friday, so it's like five stories and three pieces like since then, and just sort of reminding myself, and it's an out-of-body experience for me when I read these things, and that's a good sign when it's like, who the hell came up with this? And it's ostensibly this simple subject, but I don't see how you could have something larger or with more emotional and philosophical heft.
No, it's an incredible piece, so you can find it at the Many Moments More blog as well. We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. From that piece to the passing of actor Tony Dow, who once upon a time played a character in a sitcom who in many ways became the prototypical big brother to people.
He became the, was he the prototypical big brother, or was he the sort of gold standard of big brothers?
That because, could be as well.
Because I don't think they're synonymous, especially in sitcoms or on TV, because if he was prototypical, he wouldn't stand out so much. Do you know what I mean? For his goodness and decency. And a good big brother is like a mini dad in a way, without the power. And so he's relied upon, and he's relied upon to be there for help, but also as a model. And I'm just sort of like going through big brothers in my mind from shows. And I think that's why he stood out so much to me, because he was unlike them. And also, it's like Mark McCain on The Rifleman as a son. He was different. He wasn't like prototypical. Do you know what I mean? He was sort of like the Tony Dow of boys who aren't big brothers, because he was an only child. So I just always remember like thinking of him as this model. And also it's interesting, because I didn't see Leave It to Beaver when it originally aired. And I was thinking today about the difference in seeing something when it originally airs and seeing something when it's on every day in syndication. And I wonder if I was almost better off with having that second avenue, whether it was with this show, Twilight Zone, The Brady Bunch, because it's there every day. Like you come home from school, and so you're getting it. You're not like quote unquote binging it, but you're getting it really like all at once, and it's washing over you. And ever since I saw the show, he just was the person I admired on it most. And it sounds a little strange, but I thought, you can learn something from this guy. And I didn't even necessarily mean in a Big Brother sense. I still think that when I watch the show. And I think that's the result of someone who possesses true goodness. True goodness is rare, that sort of altruism and doing the right thing and being your brother's keeper, which is really what he was, not just for the Beaver, but think of how he sort of liaised, smoothed things over between his parents and the great, and he was great, the great Eddie Haskell. He just was ahead of his time as a young man. He was mature, and he was still a kid with the foibles of a kid, but if I had like a kid or a brother, I'd want them to be like that.
Yeah, and you know, obviously he was playing a part and reading lines that somebody else wrote, but just seeing comments from people we've had on the show who knew him pretty well, especially Billy Mumy, who was such a great child actor at the time, and then Jerry Mathers himself. What they talk about, the kind of person that was their friend for more than six decades, seemed to be an awful lot like the guy that Tony Dow played, that he was just a decent stand-up guy.
I think he was a brave man, too, because in the 80s he was talking about some of the things that he battled in terms of depression. And you know what? In this age when people are encouraged to almost make things up, but to actually make things up so they can get attention, and there's nothing that you can't say about yourself where people aren't supposed to feel bad for you. People do not talk openly. Even now, they never have, but they do not speak openly about what they're going through. And at the time, in theory, that was something that was harder to do. I've never really understood that because I've never had a hard time being open about anything that I might be facing or feeling or dealing with. Because no one has ever looked at anyone who's been honest about that and thought they were anything but strong. But people think that the converse is going to happen. And he obviously understood that that wasn't the case. And I bet he helped a lot of people in the 80s. And it's almost like, I know it's like fiction and nonfiction, but you could have seen that character on the show if we followed him into adulthood, well, beyond like the 80s show. He would be like that because he was that kind of person. I think that character, the way he was portrayed, was shot through with that kind of grace. I mean, it really is a form of grace. That's just a rare person in life or on TV.
Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Let's shift gears a bit and talk about a different group of people. They're the ones that you encounter while you're running stairs.
Right. So, I don't feel bad about this. No one's going to make me feel bad about this. But I wrote about this guy in the blog. This is Guy. He wasn't there today. I was late today. I only did 1,000 stairs. Not proud of that. But there's this city employee. These are all city employees. And he comes out, and there is this granite island at the bottom of the government center, the city hall stairs, the stairs that everybody knows. And he must weigh 400 pounds, which I might feel bad about commenting upon if, like I said in the blog, I didn't hear the things that came out of this guy's mouth when he's on his phone. Beyond like the like anal destruction of the English language, the stuff he says, off color wouldn't do it justice. It's just not good person stuff. Anyway, he's coated up to the neck in like these green web tattoos. And he's dressed in black, and he watches me, like, intently. Sweat's flying off of me. It's very strange. He just watches me, like he's locked in on me, and he lights up a cigarette, and he takes these slow drags as he watches me. It disturbs me, Kimball. And then I'm between sets, and I'm doing push-ups. He lights up another one, and he has a hot coffee with him. I'm thinking, like, wow, if I could ever be so comfortable, I mean, this guy, like, no problem whatsoever. It's like this, such a bizarre juxtaposition. And he's really, he's just, what, no problem. He's just watching.
But you've got your workout. He's got his.
Well, it's like, when I'm out and like some hot girl like runs past me, I'm always thinking like, you're doing some extra stairs today, right? That's how I'm thinking. Then this guy's like, pound some subs when I get home. Like, I'm not motivating him at all, Kimball. Like, there's nothing.
No.
And like, I'm hurting out there because it's been a miss. I hate summer, as you know. This has been like an even more hateable summer. I mean, honestly, you people out there are like, I love this summer. I have a theory about all of you. I don't think you get off your asses that much because it's too hot, like, to enjoy it if you're moving about at all. So I don't believe that. I think you're in an air conditioned car or something. You're not, like, walking around and, like, seeing the sight. So not to, like, badmouth the audience, but I don't have respect for those people. You should like the winter. Anyway, there he is. And then they have these city employees, and it doesn't matter who these guys are. There should be, like, an expose on this, these people on the stairs. As I wrote on the blog, they sweep up the stairs. There's not that much on the stairs. It's not like a ticker tape parade every day. These guys. What a racket this is. That's why it should be like a news feature. I've never seen people move this slowly. As I wrote in the blog, the dead interred at Forest Hills have a quicker pace. And then if they go off to Dunkin' Donuts, they make like a coffee run, they're gone for an hour, man. It's not break, because once they come back, they're heading out again. Like, I don't know how you can be walking technically this slowly and like not fall over. It's like they all have mastered this in-between gravity movement world, and they're all getting paid. And you know what? This is where I don't even care if I sound like I'm 400, because I don't think I do. I believe in, no matter what you're doing, you do it to the best of your ability, and you do it honestly. I like, whether that's writing my nickel, or that's writing an opera, or it's chopping wood, or whatever. So I'm kind of disgusted by this.
Do you think there's any chance this guy goes home or goes off with his buddies, if he has them somewhere, and says, I got to tell you about this guy I see every day. I'm there drinking my coffee, having my smoke, and I see this guy just running up and down the stairs. He's dripping sweat. He's not going anywhere. He's just up and down the stairs. Can you believe this guy?
Well, that would be a good get for you if you could, like, book him on a segment tomorrow and be like, yesterday we had point, now we have counterpoint.
Yeah, I think.
Guy, and you know what, Kimball? I've been kind, but I'm going to undo that right now. I am shortchanging this guy 100 pounds. Like, this is someone who, I feel if something happens, I am not going to be able to step in and, like, one time I got thrown off the stairs. I shouldn't even say this. There was like a light dusting of snow. So they turned that into like a 4-day job. And they tried to kick me off. Like, they owned the city employees when they're like doing their slow shoveling. And I said to this one very large man, I said, hey, I hope you don't go down, man. I don't know CPR. I'll call, but it's going to be a wait.
From there, let's close with a little music discussion about a wonderful live recording, The Band, at the Hollywood Bowl from 1970. A real important point in their career, and wow, what a great sound. And right, this was an audience recording of The Band?
It's not just an audience recording, but it's one of the first, it's in that first wave of bootlegs. So for people who don't know, bootlegs became a thing on vinyl. Labels like Rubber Dubber and Trademark of Quality is probably like two of the more famous ones. Around like 1969, a lot of the Dylan Baseman tapes first were available on a bootleg, or not a lot, but like in terms of how much there was there, but like a handful. And so you get like that first wave Beatles Get Back sessions, Led Zeppelin doing whatever in 1970. And this was a cornerstone bootleg. It's something that you need to have. And your unreleased music collection, the band at the Hollywood Bowl in this July of 1970. So that is going to see them like after their first like couple like accepted classic albums. And it's kind of a strange setting to imagine the band. I don't know why, because to me, they're in my mind, they're always like it's some sort of honky tonk or some crossroads like fish fried, you know what I mean, rather than like L.A. and out there and in the bowl and everything. But I don't know. The Doors played there, so it also does make a certain amount of sense. But it's one of their best live recordings. And like you said, it's an audience tape. So it might take for some people a little bit of adjusting too. But a band like the band was so reliant on harmonies, a lot like the Grateful Dead in a way.
Mm.
And they stick the harmonies over and over again. I mean, there's just this.
It's the best version of The Weight I think I've ever heard.
Oh, yeah. And what you really notice, too, with the opening Robbie Robertson guitar lick is that it's obviously a song that doesn't have a guitar solo. And I feel like when you really understand music, rock and roll music, whatever it is, you start to notice that some of the best guitar playing, guitar parts are in songs where there's no solo. I mean, the Who were often that way, and so there's no solo. Like, there aren't that many solos anyway in like the band's catalog. So I love this song because it's one of those story songs where someone who's a master storyteller does not need a lot to make a lot. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
It's not like MacGyvering a story, but if you understand humanity and the relational, all you have to do is fit people in the natural way that they fit with each other. And the story is going to emerge from that. So it's like a story of these exchanges, these fleeting exchanges in life. And like when Rick Danko comes in for like that middle part about like Crazy Chester and wanting a room, and it's just this eternal, I know it comes from like the late 60s, but it's just like one of those primordial songs that stands outside time. Like, it's hard to pin it down to a time, and so you get more of an electric guitar flavor, I'd say, with this version of The Weight too than you do in the studio counterpoint.
And much like some of the Dead live performances we've talked about, this really shows off the talents of the band members.
These guys, and it's a good comparison, it's like the Dead, they were so musical. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know that I'd classify, like, for instance, the Beatles so musical. Paul McCartney to a degree. But these were guys who were just, like, natural musicians who could all do these different things, and almost like a player in baseball who can play all over the diamond, right? But like at a high all-star type level. I don't know, Craig Biggio, he's like a center fielder, he's a second baseman, he's a catcher, like that sort of thing. This is how they worked. And you listen to a song that's so richly textured, like The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. And you also think at the same time that if like the wrong idiots got a hold of this, it's a good thing sometimes that idiots are so uncultured, because they'd be like, wait, that's about the South, and that means it's pro, like, slavery. And no, do you remember recently the hate mail I got about the Buster Keaton piece I wrote?
Yes.
From the guy? Yeah. And he was like this, like, fat white dude. He's like, I have a black kid, and you're so racist because of Buster Keaton and the General. It's like, I don't know, maybe don't, like, use your kid as, like, this, like, racial prop. That seems kind of disturbing. I wouldn't want that if I was the kid. But, like, people get a hold of these things, and they try to twist them. And that's not how, like, history worked or the Civil War went down or anything like that. That you have these mostly Canadians and one Southerner able to tell this story. To me, The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down is so much richer than any iteration of Gone with the Wind. And obviously, it's much more compact.
Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Subscribe to the blog, Many Moments More, and check out The Nickel and all the other great works that are there. Colin, thank you as always, my friend. We'll do it again next week.
Okay.